inspiring interviews with today's top landlords.
This is the Rental Income Podcast.
And now, Dan Lay.
Dave, you wanted to quit your job, but your rental income wasn't exactly where you wanted it to be, but you ended up leaving your job. How did you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had decided to get my real estate broker's license to become an agent about 9 months before I actually resigned. So I was able to start my sort of second career while I was doing my first and have them overlap. Even that didn't provide me anywhere near as much income as my W-2 right away, because being a broker, you have to build relationships and a book of business. And it takes a year or two, I think, to gain traction. But I had some savings and I had listened to enough, you know, podcasts like yours and read books to believe that I should make the jump, and I believed in myself, and it worked out really well.
When you didn't have that 9-to-5 job anymore and you were able to focus full time on real estate, both as an agent and as an investor, someone looking to buy more rental properties, is that when your rental income really increased to the point where it was covering all your living expenses?
Yeah. I mean, within a year I was making, you know, more than I used to. And within 2 years, I mean, it's probably 10 or 20 times more. So, you know, I had thought all along, maybe I'm costing myself money by staying in these golden handcuffs and this, you know, comfortable job that pays the bills. And I've definitely found that to be true in my case. I don't think that would be true for everyone. But I do have the sort of entrepreneur bug, and I wanted to scratch that itch.
I've got a great show for you today. Some of the things we're going to be talking to Dave about are the type of return that he's looking for when he wants to buy a new property. We'll talk about a pretty creative way that he's been able to cut his expenses to make his property's cash flow better. And we'll get his opinion on whether he thinks you're better off having just a couple of rental properties or a bigger rental portfolio. Joining us on the show today from Yarmouth, Maine is Dave Holloman. We'll take a really quick break to thank our sponsors. We'll come right back and we'll talk to Dave. There's a ton of paperwork involved when you're getting a mortgage on a rental property. Lenders are going to want to see 2 years of tax returns, pay stubs, bank statements. I mean, it's a lot of work and a huge hassle. Shaylee Ridge from Ridge Lending Group has a brand new loan program where she doesn't care about any of that. She actually doesn't need any paperwork from you at all. She's just going to look at the deal. The most important thing she wants to see is, does it make sense? Is the property going to cash flow? If it does, she'll give you a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Now, the rates are going to be a little bit higher than a traditional full-doc loan, but it's still a great deal, somewhere between 3.9% and 5%. She can close quickly, and there's no hassle. She can even do a cash-out refi with this program. If you want to learn more, just reach out to Shaylee at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's R-I-D-G-E. lendinggroup.com, NMLS 42056. A good deal on a rental property isn't going to last very long. To win properties today, you need to move quickly when a deal comes on the market, but it takes time to analyze a property. I want to let you know about an app where you can analyze deals on your phone in seconds. It's called Ask Rick. That's R-I-C for Rental Income Calculator. You can analyze a deal with the push of a button. You can figure out the rent, your mortgage payment, your expenses, and figure out the cash flow. If the numbers make sense, you can make an offer right there on the app, or you can send a calendar invite to your agent to see the property in person. Ask Rick is currently offering a free 7-day trial. Just search for Ask Rick in the App Store or go to Just Ask Rick. That's R-I-C, justaskrick.com. So, Dave, you were saying at the beginning that you quit your job before you had enough rental income. How many doors were you at when you actually quit?
I was at 33 doors, almost all of which were residential apartments, you know, 1- and 2- and 3-bedroom apartments. And if I had not reinvested any money in my buildings and I had simply taken all of that cash flow, maybe it would have been almost enough to live on or enough. But for better or worse, I'm constantly reinvesting money, and I have to stop myself sometimes from over improving things. But I think that that works out well in the end, because I've actually, you know, come to learn that appreciation is actually more powerful than cash flow, you know, at the end of the day. And so the reinvestment has definitely paid off.
Sure. Yeah. Appreciation really, really is powerful. It's just incredible. And as you get a bigger and bigger portfolio, you just have more units appreciating. So yeah, it really, really can snowball.
You know, I think cash flow is critical to get into something. I would never buy an asset that didn't either have or have the quick potential for, you know, positive cash flow, but it's not the be all and end all. And I think it can actually be the dangly key distraction for investors away from, you know, a bigger picture, where in an ideal world, you'd want to balance, you know, your properties where you can get both cash flow and appreciation.
Now, where are you today? How many doors do you have today?
A little bit north of 130. We're, you know, been acquiring quite a few this year, so it's always a moving target, and sometimes we're building, you know, new units in vacant space or things like that. But that's about the number, and it's about 2/3 residential and 1/3 commercial. And the commercial is a mix, mostly office, but we have some restaurant, you know, and other types as well, like retail.
You mentioned at the beginning that you're a realtor, and I know you've got some other businesses and other income streams. If they all went away today, would your cash flow support you 100%? Like, would you be able to pay all your bills on your cash flow?
Yes, at this point it would.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, congrats. That is really awesome. So now let's talk about when you're looking at a deal. Do you have like a certain dollar amount that you want to make per deal, or is there another way that you analyze this? Like, how do you look at a deal?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's definitely not a specific dollar amount, although I would say my sights are set increasingly higher over time. You know, I want it to be in the, you know, 5 or 6 figures in the near term, not in the 3 or 4 figures, but I think about most investments in terms of cash on cash. You know, what is a dollar going into this going to get me each year coming out? And I basically want that dollar to give me at least $1.10. You know, I want a 10% cash on cash return annually to, you know, be interested in something.
Are you looking at a 10% return when you buy it, or are you looking to get that return after you maybe fix the property up a little bit and increase the rents?
Yeah, great question. The 10% return is definitely after stabilization. And part of the way that, you know, investors can find good deals is find a building that on paper looks like a 1% return or a negative 10% return, and find out if there's something other people are missing, something you would do differently. So when I put together my performas and analyze properties, whether it's a single family home or, you know, a 50 unit, you know, building, I'm not really as interested in what it is now as what it would be and will be if properly managed. And that's where you can kind of find the needle in the haystacks, you know, in the real estate market, even in hot markets like today.
Now, I'm just curious here, and I don't want this question to come off wrong, or, you know, I think you've done some pretty awesome stuff with your investing, but we talk to a lot of people on the podcast that have built smaller portfolios. You know, maybe they've got a few houses that are paid off, or they have 5 or 10 properties that are generating really good cash flow. Did you ever think about having a smaller portfolio that maybe provided just as much money, or maybe you were making more per door? Like, did you ever consider going that route, or was getting a bigger portfolio really important to you?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's funny because my brother and I are the opposite types of investors. And he's very much that type of investor that, you know, he's paying off his primary home, and he's just got a handful of units that he's spending a lot of time on and getting a very high, you know, cash flow on. And part of what I love about real estate is there's no wrong way to do it. You know, right, there's a way that will fit almost any personality type. You know, for me, I think part of the reason I have a lot of units is because I have learned a lot about leverage and try to understand the power that good debt can have. And so in an environment, you know, I thought we had high inflation, you know, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was part of why I was, you know, relishing fixing in, you know, 5 and 10 year or even 30 year, you know, fixed terms on loans at low interest rates that, you know, in a real sense are negative rates because the actual, you know, price, rent, and overall inflation is higher than the 3% or 4%, you know, you're paying on your loans. So you're essentially getting paid to own these properties. So I do think from a financial point of view, paying off properties is not giving you a very good return. And it also exposes you to legal risk where, you know, if someone slips and falls and gets sued, you know, if you own $1 million of real estate free and clear, you could lose that $1 million entirely. Right. Whereas, sure. You know, if the bank owns 80 or 70 or 60% of it, you know, that's not as appealing for, you know, an attorney to go after because they're going to get a smaller, you know, payout from a lawsuit. So there are other reasons that you might want to, you know, consider using leverage. But for me, I've just enjoyed being able to, you know, put properties in better condition, fix them up. And, you know, where I didn't start with any capital of my own, the path I've chosen is working with investors and working as a team to try to build, you know, a network and, you know, let people invest their savings and do good things, you know, in our community in Maine.
You know, something else that I always think is interesting to think about is when you have one or two rental properties, it can feel less risky because you only have one or two. But if those two tenants don't pay rent, you've got nothing. Where in your case, with over 100 rentals or 100 doors, if a few tenants move out, you probably don't even realize that or it doesn't affect you as much.
Exactly. You're diversifying your risk. So I always prefer buildings with a lot of small units rather than a few big units, mm-hmm. you know, because again, you're able to sustain vacancy and do the remodeling without feeling a sort of mad rush to it, you know, as you would in larger contexts. So I think when you're first starting out, yeah, it's you're at your highest risk level. So you want to be careful because when you buy that first single family home as your first investment, you know, you're all or nothing. You're fully mm-hmm. occupied or fully vacant.
Now let's talk about controlling expenses because you know it's exciting to talk about growing your income, but I feel like a lot of times you can be more profitable if you can really watch your expenses. Is there anything that you've been able to do to maybe lower your expenses and make your rentals more profitable?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I live in Maine where we have a very cold winter. And so there's a huge heating need. And I think most climates in the US are going to fall into, you know, one of the two categories of either a lot of heating need or a lot of cooling need. And in either case, a great way to reduce expenses is if you inherit a building where the landlord is paying those heating and cooling costs, how can you reduce those costs? And there's two big ways. I mean, one is transition from a central heating or cooling system that the landlord pays and can't easily bill back to tenants into individual units. And the best way to do that I found is using heat pumps. So I'll inherit a, you know, let's say a 4-unit building with an oil burning furnace that's, you know, the landlord's spending, you know, $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 a year to, you know, operate. I'll go and install, you know, 4 heat pumps for, you know, $15,000 to $20,000. And then tenants are paying their own heating and cooling, from their electric bill. And I can actually charge a slightly lower and more competitive base rent, because of that. But I just saved a huge, you know, 10 or 20% of my annual costs right. or more, you know, by changing the way that heating is done. Often you can't, just stop heating a building because pipes in the basement might freeze, you know, in a colder climate. And a great way to reduce that risk is by using spray foam insulation, either all the way from the rim joist down to the floor or part of the way, you know, to the frost line or those sort of things. And, you know, I've had buildings where I get a 100 or 200% return in year one because half of the heating cost of the building was just heating the basement. You know, wow. Which is crazy because yeah. The earth under the frost line is 55 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, almost anywhere. So as long as you can insulate your basement and not be losing a lot of air, you know, in or out, it's going to stay above freezing.
Right. Yeah, that's really smart. So you're able to put that cost onto the tenant with having individual heat pumps, and then you're able to charge the tenant a lower rent, and that makes you more competitive in the marketplace.
Absolutely. I think, you know, from a marketing standpoint, if I'm charging $900 and explaining that on average you'll pay $100 in utility bills versus the landlord next door with the identical unit charging $1,000, you know, I win 8 or 9 times out of 10. I mean, there's some tenants that maybe they had a bad experience with utility bills and they want to just have the peace of mind of knowing the landlord's going to pay for it or what have you. And it varies by, you know, locality and by unit class. I mean, so you want to generally not go too far away from what's normal, you know, in your area. And it's interesting because there's certain towns, even in Maine, where utilities are always paid by the landlord, whereas in other places it's more mixed, mm-hmm. you know, so you have to keep tenant expectations in mind. But in general, I do prefer tenants being responsible for their own utilities because it just leads to less waste, you yeah. know, in buildings where the landlord's paying that we inherit. I just had this the other day. I said to my manager, can you get, you know, Brandy to shut her window? It's November. You know, oh I'm paying gosh. The heat. This isn't good.
Right. Yeah. You know, tenants just don't care. You know, they're not paying for it. It's not an expense that they're seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah. They'll get very frugal very quickly sure. when, you know, they're paying for the thermostat. And I think that's really better for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, they can control it and pay for what they want. And the landlord, you know, doesn't have that expense on their books. And it, you know, dramatically increases the value of a building. You know, again, if you decrease your expenses on commercial property by 10 or 20%, you know, that is a 10 or 20% or more, you know, addition to the building value, you know, depending sure. on the cap rates in your area. So, you know, every dollar of savings you can get is often $10 of building price. You know, right. it's a really powerful driver.
Right. Now, let's talk about how you're managing your properties. I know property management has been a challenge for you over the years, and it's interesting to kind of see how you've evolved your management as you've grown out your portfolio. So maybe we can walk through how you've done it. So when you first started, were you self-managing or did you have a property manager?
Great question. I self-managed my first single family rental property. I was putting up mouse traps. I was fixing their floorboards. I you know, oversaw the new kitchen, you know, remodeling. I did it all myself. And pretty quickly, I realized that, you know, with my full-time day job at Bowdoin College, I was not going to be able to do a lot of physical labor on properties. So I started working with a handyman I had met and, you know, other contractors that I found online or through, you know, questioning relationships and that sort of thing. And pretty soon, you know, I bought properties that sort of came with a property manager. So I thought, oh, great. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'll just work with that person. And mm-hmm. they were kind of old school cash and checks and their bookkeeping wasn't keeping up. And it really created cash flow problems because they didn't know what to pay me. So they didn't pay me. that had to end pretty quickly. And I had learned, you know, again, from listening to podcasts and talking with friends who did this on a bigger scale that, you know, you kind of have two options. It's either find a really good third-party manager or start your own company or do your own management. And I decided for that latter path. So I somehow convinced my best friend from graduate school, who's a retired Navy officer and looking for a job that, the job could be managing my properties and we would start a company together and try to grow that company over time. And that's what we've done. You know, we started with just him and me and both of us doing all the work, you know, directly with that. And we now have, you know, 6 part and full-time employees and, you know, growing quickly. And, you know, property management, I think most people would tell you is not a, you know, high margin business. It's not highly profitable, but it's reliable. It's steady, you know, and once you start managing a property, you know, whether it's one of your own or for a third party, you're likely to be there for years, not months, you know, so it generates very sustainable income, you know, which I think is a very good thing in this day and age. but I've never earned a dime from my property management business directly. I've used all that money to pay, you know, my partner and our employees and our contractors and reinvest in the business. And, you know, now we have hats and jackets and that kind of thing, website, et cetera. But I'm doing it because the real money is in the buildings. It's in the cash flow and the appreciation from the buildings. And you want an A team doing that because you'll get great tenants, you'll get great rents, they'll be in great shape. And then when the appraiser comes, you know, to appraise it, when you're selling or refinancing, you'll get a great price. That's the hope. So that's the long game, you know, that I'm playing by controlling property management. And when I have a vacancy, I can, you know, fill it very quickly by, you know, cutting down to a low price, where when I was, you know, sort of in the hands of third parties, we would have vacancies for weeks or months. And I wasn't able to really see the effort and the showings, and it was frustrating. Whereas now, if we have a vacancy for any long length of time, it's my fault. I know it. There's no one else to blame but me. And I can change it if I pay attention and want to.
That makes a lot of sense. And you're giving your tenants better quality service. They're keeping the buildings up better. I mean, that makes so much sense to manage it the way that you want to manage it.
Absolutely. And it was on your show some years ago, I heard a great landlord, you know, say it very eloquently, better than me, which is that, you know, you should treat tenants like your customers, you know, as if you're running a shoe store, and, you know, you should take off their shoes and help them try on the other ones. That's the kind of customer service we want to give to tenants, because they're the ones paying your mortgage. They're the ones paying your taxes, your utility bills. They're the ones putting profit in your bank account to send your kids to college, et cetera. So, you know, we always try to treat tenants as residents and call them residents and give them that level of respect that we would want to be shown if we were renting the same unit.
I love it. Well, if anybody wants to learn more about Dave, I've got a link to his website on my website. I've also got his email address on there if you want to reach out to him. You can find it all at rentalincomepodcast.com/episode342. If Dave inspired you and you're ready to buy your first rental property, or you want to add to your portfolio, the lender that I recommend is our sponsor today. It's Chailey Ridge from Ridge Lending Group. Chailey is a nationwide lender, and her specialty is helping investors finance rental properties. She has a ton of different loan programs, including a first position HELOC. If you want to find out more, or if you are ready to get started today, you can contact Chailey at ridgelendinggroup.com. That's RIDGE, lendinggroup.com, NMLS 42056. Thank you so much for checking out the podcast today. Make sure you subscribe. We put out new interviews every single Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.